welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 285 of the podcast. And it is the 1st of September 2016 as I record this, a little early, as I am off to London for the Screenwriters Festival, which I'm not really writing a screenplay anymore. I'm hoping to work with other people on that. But it's always a great learning experience about storytelling and dialogue. So I'm particularly interested in those sessions. And also looking forward to getting back to the big smoke and catching up with London friends. So today I have an interview with Tim Grawl, who many of you will know from the Story Grid podcast with Sean Coyne, but also from his book, Your First 1,000 Copies. And Tim spends the majority of his time working with top authors to launch their books to the top of the USA Today and New York Times bestseller lists. His clients include people like Dan Pink, Pamela Slim, Charles Duhigg and Hugh Howey. But he's also on the path to writing his own first novel, which he shares about openly in the Story Grid podcast. So in the first section of the show, we talk about how writing fiction is so different from nonfiction and how he really has beginner's mind when it comes to that. And then we get into his expertise around book marketing and book launching, including how new authors can scale marketing strategies of big name authors and permission marketing, amongst other things. So if you're not into the writing fiction bit, just skip forward to the book marketing section, because Tim really is just one of the top people in the industry, and a lot of big name authors hire him to run their book launches. So I'm very happy to pick his brain. And I am such a fan of Tim's systematic approach to book launches that we are going to do a webinar together on Thursday, 15th of September at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. And we'll be going through the three-part framework used to launch dozens of New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling books, plus how to launch your book with 25-plus Amazon reviews. So whether you need book reviews for your launch or relaunch, or you want to know this three-part framework, you can join us live or get the replay by registering at thecreativepen.com/Tim, T-I-M. And yeah, I'm really impressed with Tim's kind of process. I think that my ad stacking launch for USA Today list was probably the first time I've actually organized things in a systematic way. So I learn a lot from Tim, and that will be a super webinar. We'll also be doing a Q&A, and those of you who are interested, go along to thecreativepen.com/Tim. Okay, so September has arrived, which is kind of crazy, and there's a bit of an autumn nip in the air here in Bath. And it also means that the August summer haze has passed away. And I have noticed that August is just ridiculously quiet and everybody's on holiday and just doing their thing and relaxing. And then September arrives and kids go back to school and it's kind of everyone's on the go. So I hope that we can all sort of get our energy back and do a big writing push in the next 3 months, because we've only got, four months till September, October, November. Yeah, 4 months until the end of the year. So lots to be getting on with, and lots of you enjoyed the Olympic time discussion last week. So let's make sure we take some steps in the right direction as we head towards the end of the year. Okay, so in publishing news this week, one of the very, you know, we had Damon Courtney on the show a few months ago, and BookFunnel has announced giveaways, which is really super useful. Go to bookfunnel.com, look in the features area at giveaways. So if you want to attract readers to sign up for your email list, this could be an easy option without building your own landing page. Now, I know that lots of authors want to set up, a free book that readers can download, but they struggle with the website, the setting up the landing page, all that type. So this could be a good way to do it if you haven't got all of that in place. So go to bookfunnel.com, check that out. Also, the Arthur C. Clarke Award in the UK for science fiction writers opens up to indie authors. And thanks to Andrew Chamberlain for letting me know about this. And I sent that over to the Sell More Book Show as well, because I think this is pretty big, because the Arthur C. Clarke Award is a prestigious award for science fiction. And they've basically said that they have to open up to self-published books, because too many of the books that they want to be included in the shortlist are self-published, which is really fascinating. It's not a completely open award, so you can't just apply. They have very high standards, and they kind of ask for books. But it is an interesting change, and I think we will see more and more of the prestigious prizes doing this over the coming years. And hopefully, we'll get to the point where this won't be news, and it won't be discussed, as authors will have parity. That's what I hope, anyway. So. That was interesting. On personal news, I'm really, really thrilled to announce that the How to Write a Novel course is open, and I'm really proud of the course, and I think it will help you if you want to write a novel, or if you've written one that isn't selling and you want to revisit the basics. It's based on writing 12 novels of my own, and actually putting the course together has helped my own process. I even have a checklist, which I've got on my desk. I'd never done a checklist before, and I've now done a checklist for the course, so I've got one for myself. And I really, like, I know it's my course, but I'm really proud of it. And because I didn't, you know, I was really struggling with this. It was just like, what is going on? Why am I finding this so hard? And I was going to write a book on it at the same time, but I can't, because writing a book is just such a big deal. And I want to get back to writing fiction. And in fact, the course really helped me come to grips with some of my own thoughts around writing fiction. You know, they do say if you want to fix something in your own mind, then teach it. And this has definitely been that experience for me. So I hope that it will help you. And I'm basically now, I'm going to start seriously plotting end of days today. I have loads of ideas, but I need to actually put it into an order. And next week, I'm going to start dictating the first draft. So by next week's show, I hope to report back on like word count, because you guys keep me accountable, which is so useful. So if you are interested in checking out the course, go to thecreativepen.com/write-novel. And it is an evergreen course, so you can take it anytime you like. But for the month of September 2016, I do have a special time-sensitive promo code for $50 off. And you can go to on the payment details screen for the full payment course, where it says redeem coupon, use the code CREATE, 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 for $50 off until the end of September 2016. Or if you have any questions, email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. So that's at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. All right. So thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. I always love getting them. And thanks for those. I always follow back on Twitter if you tweet me, and I just love to hear from you and see your pictures. So Helen Wilkie says, listening to the podcast while relaxing on my balcony, enjoying a beautiful late summer evening in Toronto. Loved the interview with Rachel Abbott. Sounded as if the two of you were having so much fun. I think we were. Chaz Syme said, listening while walking the beautiful nature trails in Bozeman, Montana, or Bozeman, Montana, which is amazing. I love, love, love the idea of a career look back on an Olympic schedule. We'll give that a shot. Marion Hill says, I appreciate Rachel's candor about her journey and success. Also, I like the tip of looking at the career in 4-year cycles. We tend to look at what's in front of us on a daily basis and not take a macro view. This is a good reminder. And Shauna took this even further. Shauna wrote a blog post. She took the challenge. After listening to the intro, she stopped the podcast and wrote a blog post about her own Olympic journey. And the link to that is in the show notes of the last show. Thank you, Shauna. I'm so pleased you took that so seriously. From Twitter, Jennifer Eremiva sent me a lovely picture of her gazpacho making. Listening to the show while making gazpacho. Daniel Hoover, love the Jen Blood episode. Listening while Parker, my new editor, is already on my back, and sent me a lovely picture of his cats. I always like getting cat pictures. Jack Arbour says, listening on the bus after returning a U-Haul after moving our stuff from Philly to Aspen. I haven't been to Aspen, but I'm pretty sure it's a really nice place. So happy moving. And Tara Jade Brown says, another awesome interview with Rachel Abbott. Honest, uplifting and fun to listen to. So there were lots more. Thank you, everybody. And as ever, please email me or tweet me with what you're doing while listening to the show and any pictures. I love knowing where you are in the world, particularly. And I love cat pictures and out your window pictures. And I love the interaction we have on the show. Okay, so today's episode is sponsored by 99 Designs, and you can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. On 99 Designs, you can get all kinds of designs for your author business, including book covers, merchandising, branding, business cards, illustrations, artwork, and much more. And we've mentioned Society 6 on the show before, and I still intend to get out some mugs for Christmas. So getting graphics for merchandising is another possibility. So how does it work? Well, you decide on what you want, you post it up for all the designers to see and describe it. And this is probably the most important bit. You need to say what you want with enough detail so you get good designs. So for example, if you want an ebook cover or a custom design, like I did a custom illustration, like I did for the map of Aotearoa, New Zealand, for the front of dark fantasy novel Risen Gods. So you want to put as much detail as possible. So genre, for example, a map for a kind of romance novel or a mystery novel might be different to a map for a dark fantasy novel or a book cover. You know, if you don't specify the genre, you just have a book title, you're going to get very, very different covers. So definitely include examples of covers you like that might be best selling in your category, or be very specific as to what you want on things like a map. Or you can just be more vague if you want to get lots of interesting designs. So for example, I did the Key to the Gates of Hell, which is on the front and in the interior of the print book of Gates of Hell. And for the key, I literally put, I want an image of a black and white, I think I said black and white, Key to the Gates of Hell. And you know, just said, go for it. And got some really interesting ideas. So anyway, once you put up your project, you'll get designs posted. It might be slow, especially if you have a sort of more detailed request, because people need time to actually do the design. And then they just start coming really fast. You can make it private if you want people to not see each other's design, and then you get more variations, or put it public so people just riff off each other. You can add feedback and comments and stars, and the designers will come back with more iterations. You can also do a poll to your audience or email list. Then you decide on a shortlist and finally pay the winner. And you only pay if you're happy, and you then exchange the design files. So it's actually a super fun process, and I've been really happy with my custom illustrations. So on 99 Designs, you can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, who also get the Patreon-only extra Q&A, which I do every month, which is an extra half an hour, 40 minutes of me answering your questions. So thanks especially to new patrons, Kent McDonald and Amy Hopkins. I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It really demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And if you want to support on Patreon, even just $2 a month, you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, thank you. And here's the interview with Tim. Hi, everyone. I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. And today I'm back with Tim Grohl. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Great to have you back on the show. Just a little introduction. Tim is the author of Your First 1,000 Copies, A Step-by-Step Guide to Marketing Your Book, and the founder of Outthink, a firm that helps authors with online marketing tools. He's also more recently the co-host of the Story Grid podcast with Sean Coyne, which I know many of you listen to. So this is quite exciting, Tim. You were last on the show, April 2015, and you were most definitely a non-fiction author with kind of designs on fiction. What has changed in the last sort of just over a year? What is the update in your writing world?
Oh my gosh. So over the summer, last summer, so a year ago, I was talking to a friend of mine about I had kind of wrapped up some projects and I was like, okay, what am I going to work on next? And I had all these kind of ideas and he's like, well, haven't you always wanted to write fiction? I've won NaNoWriMo a couple times and written some other stuff. I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, why don't you do that? Like, go after that. And I'm like, and it was like this long pause and I said, because I don't know I can be successful at that. And he's like, well, that seems like a pretty shitty reason not to do something. And so my way of learning to do something is to go out and find really smart people that already know how to do it and then get them to teach me. And so I had a couple years before, a year before or something, had like kind of little bit of connection to Sean. Like we had traded a couple emails about something, but I didn't know him very well. So I just sent him an email. It's like, hey, can I have like 30 minutes of your time? I got like some questions about fiction. He's like, sure. So and I'm really respectful of people's time. So I like had my questions written out. I was just gonna like blow through them and then let him off the phone. So I asked my first question. He never answered it. And we spent like 45 minutes just talking about theory of fiction and beginning hook, middle build, ending payoff, and like all this stuff. He's like throwing all this stuff at me, and I'm like, I don't know, because I had read StoryGrid. I'd read his book, which I have right here.
Me too.
And like I had read it, and that's what prompted me to call him. And so at the end, I just started asking because I do online marketing, so I'm like, well, he just spent 45 minutes helping me. I know he's building the StoryGrid platform, so let me just offer, like, what are you working with? So we started talking, and he's like, well, I'm writing for the blog, but it's really hard to write all this content, and I want to create more content for it, but I don't know what I'm going to do. And I was like, well, what if we just did this thing where like we get on Skype and I just ask you all of my like idiot newbie questions and you just answer them and we'll record it. And I'm like, I'll do everything. Like I'll do the editing, like I'll take care of the website, like I'll do everything. Literally, it's a week of your time. And he's like, okay, let's do it. So that's what started it. Was just I wanted to learn how to write fiction, and I didn't want to do it by writing 2 million shitty words first. So that's what started. So I've been working with him. I think we just put up like episode 44 or something like that. So it's approaching a year that we've been doing this together, and it's been amazing and awful and embarrassing and like I've literally, because I record here, like there's been times where he's been talking and I'm like back with like this,
With head in hands for the audio feed.
Because our agreement was it would be 100% open. And so something like around the 10th or 12th episode, I actually sent him a scene I wrote. And before, so I sent it to him a couple days before, and we get on to record. And before we hit record, he's like, okay, well, how do you want to do this? And I'm like, well, let's pretend that you're my editor and I've hired you as my developmental editor, and you just give me feedback and we just get on the phone. He's like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, just hit me with it. It's so just for an hour. He's like, well, this was wrong and here's why. And this was like, just ripped it to shreds. And I'm like, all right. And so I had to
But I think that's been the good thing about the show. And I mean, and sometimes I have been listening to it and gone, oh no, that was just, that was such a basic question. But the thing is, you've had beginner's mind. And so you've asked the questions that people further down the line would forget to ask. And also Sean forgets what he knows because he knows so much. So when he says something like, middle build and like everyone knows what that is, and then you go, well, what's that? So that
Well,
beginner's mind is great.
it's been interesting on his part because I've stumped him because I've asked such basic questions that he hasn't answered in probably 20 years because he's working with professional writers. And so I'll ask him this question. He's like, well, I haven't had to explain this in a while, And so it's been really good. And I do feel like it's been really helpful for the people listening, and we just like, it just keeps building in listenership. So, I'm taking that as a good sign. And, so that's what I've been doing. I'm trying to like actually get back and answer the question you asked is, you know, so it's been this long process of submitting scenes, having them kind of rip it apart, and then, you know, diving into other things. And then I actually wrote an entire draft, and like the feedback was basically like, yeah, this doesn't work.
I listened to that episode. It was painful for you, mate.
Yeah. But the thing is that most writers write that and they shop it around to agents, and the agents kind of give them this vague, like, no, I don't want to, and you know, I don't want to represent this. And so they're left with this manuscript that is broken, but they don't know why. Mm. And so it's nice because Sean, you know, breaks it down into why. And it's funny because he kept trying to like soften it. And I'm like, I'm going to have to throw this whole thing out, aren't I? And he's like, yeah, you know, like, so,
but that's really, I think it's been great. But what's interesting, so you're a successful guy, you've written nonfiction, you've helped a lot of people launch their books, like your definition of success is pretty high level, I guess. How much harder is writing fiction than you expected? Like what has surprised you about, you know, I guess becoming a beginner?
Well, man, that's a great question. I'm trying to think about. So the most surprising thing I found is how quickly it becomes complex. Like he'll explain something to me and I genuinely feel like I got it. And then I go to do it and I lose it so fast. So it feels like he pours a bunch of sand in my hands and I'm like, I got this. And I go to like walk with it and it just falls right out of my hands. And so I got to go back and talk to him about it again. So the constant like paradox of simple and complex that goes into fiction writing. And because there is no like writing nonfiction is hard, but in a different way. It's mostly just building an argument in a correct way. I'm struggling with my next nonfiction book right now too. Because they're like, Sean will contradict himself. So one week he'll say to do it one way and the next week he'll say to do it another, but they're both right, which is super frustrating for somebody like me that just tell me what to do. So that's been really hard, but the beginner mindset, I feel like I try to keep with everything, because if I ever feel like I figured it out, that's the moment everything's over, no matter what you're doing. And so I try to bring to everything that I do this beginner mindset of I'm here to learn. And that's what, I mean, even in my business that I've been successful in, when I want to reach the next level of success and I don't know how to get there, I do the exact same thing. I go find somebody that's already done it and I bug the crap out of them until they tell me what to do. And so that part has been really good and kind of expected, but I honestly, like, this is so dumb. I'm like, I keep thinking like, I didn't think it'd take this long. Like, I thought it's been like 10 months. Why am I not good at this yet? You know? But I think that we have to bring that kind of, if we actually knew how hard these things were going to be, I think we would give up. So we kind of have to bring in this like naivety of like, oh, I got this, you know. Yeah,
I know how to write dialogue. You just write, you know, it down, whatever it is.
Well, and we record them and then post them. So I kind of forget which one's out into the world, but in the last episode, he said, here, I have it here, 'cause like, I don't want to ever forget it. The quote is, he said about my latest scene, I found it unique and compelling, which is awesome. Right. And then he said, unlike any of his previous scenes we've worked through. And I'm like, he's literally read like 100 of my scenes. And I'm like, okay.
I've got one unique scene. Well, that's great. You can hang a whole book on one unique scene.
Well, and it was the first time like I sent it to him and he's like, I read it And I forgot his exact words, but basically I read it. It's good. Keep writing. And I'm like, what? Like,
yeah.
I'm allowed to keep going. Like, I don't have to like stop and redo it all again. And so, so that's what I'm in the middle of, is we decided with this next draft, instead of me writing it from start to finish, we're going to kind of take it at sections. So I've written the first two scenes and they're approved. And so now I'm in the middle of writing the next eight scenes, and then we'll go through that.
Well, that's so interesting. That's actually how James Patterson works with his co-authors. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, I actually think that, and I'm going to try and do something like that with my editor, with my next book, is almost give her like a story outline to edit before I write the scenes, to see if that, like how you're doing it, to sort of not shortcut the process, but make sure the story is working, and then kind of working it through that way.
Where you're like, here's what's going to happen at the end of the beginning hook. Here's what's going to happen at the end of the middle build. And then here's how the story is going to end. And those are like the signposts. We figured that part out. So we kind of know the story arc. And so the first signpost in my story is going to be, she finds out her brother's actually alive, and that prompts her to like go into the new world in my story. And so now I've had my first two scenes of the beginning hook. So the, you know, 12 to 15 scenes. And I just have to get from there to the brother. She finds out the brother and she goes into the new world. That's, and then we're going to stop there and then rework that till it's ready. And then I get to go to the next signpost.
So
it's been this, you know, it's been a process for sure. But I will say, and I can say pretty confidently, like, I am significantly better than I was 10 months ago when we started this. And it's because, you know, I've been reading a lot about like, the research. I always, Dr. Anders Ericsson, into deliberate practice. And one of the hallmarks of deliberate practice is short feedback loops. And that is what is missing in almost all writers' repertoire, is they don't have short feedback loops. They have long feedback loops. So they'll spend 10 months writing a 100,000-word manuscript, and they don't get any feedback on their writing until it's done. And sometimes not even then. And then again, they get all this kind of vague feedback of like, nobody likes it. So they like chuck that and they start a new one, and they've gotten no feedback. Where my feedback loop is like every 1500 words. And like, until he feels like I'm good enough to write 1500 words on my own, he doesn't let me anymore try to write 6,000 or 8,000 or 60,000.
So might explain why a site like Wattpad is doing so well, and how people who are writing on Wattpad, you know Wattpad?
I've heard of it. I've never used it before.
No, I haven't used it. And it's a lot more YA type thing, but people post a chapter, and then it's like a, you know, social network. People are rating the chapters and saying stuff about the chapters, and then people are writing the next chapter. And there have been some big book deals out of Wattpad, because you're putting up literally a chapter and then you're getting feedback. And some of the, you know, some of the storytellers there, and I say storytellers because some of them are really rough first drafts that you would never, that's why I struggle with the site. I've only got full books up there. I haven't written as I go, but the people who are doing it are getting a short feedback loop. So that makes you better faster, I guess.
Well, I don't want to like comment on something I don't understand, which would be Wattpad. My worry there would be two things. One is you're getting amateur feedback.
Yes, that's true.
Like, you know, I don't, so in a lot of times in the podcast, I relate it to, I do Olympic weightlifting, and which are extremely complex movements. And, I wouldn't want an amateur Olympic weightlifter critiquing my lifting, because they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Mm. Like, I want somebody that's been doing it a long time. They can look at it and be like, your feet are doing this wrong, or, you know, you're doing this before you do this, and you got to switch it, you know, like that kind of stuff. So one is, I would be careful about getting amateur feedback, because everybody thinks they're an expert. And the other is, even if I had access to 10 experts, I would still only want one to give me advice. Because the problem is there's like 10 different paths to success. And this is true in fiction for sure, because there's no one answer to any problem. Like I've had several people, like I had one lady like emailing me, who's an editor, like emailing me her feedback on like every episode. And I had to kind of block it out, because it may be great feedback and that would be awesome, except it's different than Sean's. Mm. And all it will do when I'm new at something is confuse me. And so Sean's an expert, and he's going to put me on a path to success. And so I try to listen to one voice. And that's kind of my rule when I'm learning something new like this, is I find an expert and I find one person, not three people or 10 people. Because when you ask 10 people, even again, if they're 10 just brilliant people, they're going to give you 10 different pieces of advice. And all it will do is put you in lockdown, because you won't know what to do. So what I found is, if you get one, even if their advice is only like 70% good, you're still going to move faster by like finding one person and taking their advice. So the biggest thing though, is I would just be careful about, like I'm an amateur writer. Like I don't want other amateur writers' feedback. Like I want good writers' feedback.
Yeah.
And if I have amateur writers emailing me, like I had several people email me and say my first draft was good, I should just go ahead and publish it. And I'm like, no, it's not. Like, it's not good. And yes, it's as good as some of the stuff that's out there, but that's not what I want. Like, I want to be good at this. And like, and so what I've decided is I will publish something when Sean says it's good enough to publish something, which is an extremely high standard, but I will not rest until I can meet that standard. And so, so that's like, that's what would make me nervous about something like that.
No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. And I don't use writers groups either. I agree with paying professionals or working with professionals, but I want to switch gears to, the marketing. Cause of course you might not be, an amazing fiction writer yet, but you are well known for launching, books into the top of the charts, and you've worked with, big name authors, including Hugh Howie, Charles Duhigg with The Habit Book, Daniel Pink, who I think is awesome. So talking about marketing now, and we'll come back to the fiction marketing in a minute, but what do these type of bestsellers, best-selling books, or the way they launch them, I guess, have in common that we can emulate as lesser known authors, I guess?
Well, so what I've seen is, so I'll answer your question just a second, but what I've seen is this stuff scales well. So a lot of times, like, you know, Stephen King comes out with a book and it sells a shitload of copies because it's on the front page of Amazon. It's on the corner end cap of every, you know, supermarket in America, and out in front in Barnes and Noble. Okay, well, that doesn't scale. That I don't get like 10% of his marketing budget because I'm 10% of an author. But the stuff that works for most authors does scale. And so what I focus on is, how do I connect an author with their audience in a way that can get their attention and drive action? So my definition of marketing is to create long-lasting connections with people and then be relentlessly helpful. And we can get into what that means. And then once you have that connection, you maintain that connection over a long period of time through permission marketing. You know, I don't know who coined it, but I learned it from Seth Godin's book, Permission Marketing. And it's basically, once you have permission to stay in contact with somebody, you can stay in contact with them long-term. And so the best way to do that is an email list, but you can do all kinds of stuff to basically create connections with your audience, and then you build that connection over a long period of time. And so when we look at like how I launched Dan Pink's book to number one on the New York Times list, we had spent 2.5 years building his platform, building his direct connection to his readers. And then when it came time to launch his book, we gave them an incentive to buy right now. And they bought the book, and they bought enough copies to put him at number one on the New York Times list. Now that's, you know, people are like, well, that's great for Dan Pink. You know, he has this huge email list. Well, when I came out with my first book, actually a couple weeks before I came out with it, I was talking to a buddy. And he's like, well, what's the title? And I said, Your First 1,000 Copies. And he had this long pause. He's like, well, I hope you sell 1,000 of them. And I was like, oh my God, I did not even consider that. Like, and so I had a much smaller email list. It was like 1,200 at the time. And I came out with the book and I sold 1,000 copies in less than 2 weeks, right? And so I didn't sell enough to hit a major bestseller list, but it scales, right? So even with a small platform, you can still come out and sell a significant amount of copies. And then I went on to sell 10,000 copies in the first year. And so what I'm always looking to do is how can an author connect with their audience and create a connection where they can reliably get their attention. And then once they have their attention, drive action. So buy a book.
Mm. So you mentioned the word helpful there, a long lasting connection by being helpful. And I totally agree with that with nonfiction. And that is what I do for nonfiction. It's very easy to be helpful when you're talking about a nonfiction book topic. But helpful is not usually the word that's associated with fiction connection. You know, it's normally entertainment in mm-hmm. some form. So what's the difference between launching and doing marketing for fiction authors as opposed to nonfiction?
So I actually have a second book that I wrote that's just on, you know, Kindle. It's called The Book Launch Blueprint. And at the beginning of that book, I talk about the fact that for you to successfully launch your book, you have to believe in your bones that it's good for people to buy. Okay. And what I found is working with both nonfiction and fiction is nonfiction can get there easier. Fiction have a really hard time getting to that point.
Mm.
And now I try to like get you to see it from the other perspective, because I read far more fiction than I do nonfiction. And fiction has added more like joy and emotion and like, just it's added more good things to my life than nonfiction ever has. And so when I, you know, and I'm thinking about this too, because I'll launch my fiction book hopefully in the next year, is like, I really think that somebody should buy my fiction book because it will make their life better. So am I being helpful by selling fiction? Yes. And like, if I turn it around and ask the author, like, has fiction touched your life? And they'll say, well, yes. It's like, well, what's your favorite book? And they'll tell me, you know, like my favorite book growing up, like I remember when I was a kid and I was too young to be reading it, but I read Jurassic Park by me. Like I was like having nightmares of dinosaurs eating me and like all this stuff. I loved it so much. And I wouldn't tell my parents I was having nightmares because I didn't want them to not let me buy Sphere,
yeah.
You know? And so, and like, I have that memory of that book, like that I love so much. And I have a more emotional connection to that book than any nonfiction book I've ever read. And so if I can create that for somebody else, like, how is that not making this world a better place? Like, how is that not helping the person on the other end? So once I believe in my bones that everybody should buy a copy of my book and it's a good thing, I'm halfway there. Like, now it's just figuring out the best way to do that. And so for fiction authors, I do believe it's being relentlessly helpful, but it's doing it in a more subtle way than like, you know, buy my book and you'll lose 20 pounds. You know, it's in a way of like, I know that I can add to your life by sharing with you stories, by sharing with you things that I've learned as I've written my books, by sharing other books that I've loved, by adding entertainment to your life. You know, I don't like hang out on the couch and watch, you know, documentaries at night. Maybe some people do. Like, I watch shows that are entertaining because that's what I want to do with my time. Mm-hmm. And so, so I'm constantly asking fiction writers. I just I did a little talk at the World Domination Summit last week in one of the breakout things. And we talked about this, and because I had this conversation with a fiction writer. It's like, what can you do to attract fiction readers? Like, could you do like I have this idea of like review other books in your genre and use that to connect with the authors and get them to share your blog post. Because, you know, if somebody comes to you and says, hey, I wrote 1,000-word blog post about how awesome your book is, like, I think you'd put that on Twitter. You'll put that on Facebook, and you'll have good feelings about that person. So when they come to you later, there's already a connection, right? Hmm. I was talking to another author the other day that's starting a podcast because he found this like 70-year-old physics professor who is a complete fantasy science fiction nerd. And what he loves doing is figuring out what science, like what science would say about what's happening in the books. Like if there's this sword that can like cut through metal, he's like, well, what would that sword have to be made of? So what they're doing is they're taking popular fantasy science fiction books and they're breaking down the science behind it. I'm like, dude, every science fiction fantasy reader would want to listen to that podcast. Like that's adding to people's lives, that's being relentlessly helpful, and it's building up a connection with his audience that's going to buy his book when it comes out. Hmm. I'm doing this, like how many people that listen to StoryGrid are going to buy my book when it comes out? I mean, come on. Like they're going, you know what I mean?
From personal experience, it'll be about 5%.
Well, I feel like, and I've seen this with working with Hugh Howey, is like when we send out an email to his list, and I mean, we haven't worked together in a little while, but I know when we send out an email to his list announcing a new book, a ton of people bought his book. Yes, it's a small percentage, but the bigger your email list gets, the more people are gonna buy from you. And again, it's a lot of times it's that first push. Like I've seen, if I can get a couple thousand books out into the world, that gives me leverage to start building up on that platform as well. So my 1,200 people that I launched my first book to allowed me to build that over a long period of time.
Mm. No, and when I said 5%, I meant 5% of your non-fiction audience will come over to your fiction audience, which is why, you know, obviously with email list, we build a separate list for our fiction list than we do for our nonfiction. But I wanted to ask you on that. So you mentioned podcasting there, which that sounded great. And you mentioned writing a blog post. We're in a very busy online environment. Do you think that podcasting has replaced blogging, or has Facebook replaced email marketing? Are we looking at a shift in what content marketing is these days?
So I look at each of these things is just tools in a toolbox. Okay. And when I'm, you know, my wife had me build this big table for our new house about 6 months ago. And when I'm building that table, I don't give a what tool I'm using. Like I figure out what I need to do, what I need to build. And then I go in my toolbox and I pull out the right tool for the job. Okay. So I am not emotionally, if it would be ludicrous to think I'm so emotionally attached to my hammer that I'm going to use it even when I need a screwdriver, right? That's crazy. But yet we get so emotionally attached to whatever content marketing tools out there that we just try to cram it into whatever we want to do instead of stepping back and say, was it good for? What is it bad for? I'm going to use it for the things it's good for and not use it for the things that it's bad for. So here's what Facebook is really bad at: permission marketing. Mm. Okay. If you build a Facebook page and say you get 10,000 people to be a fan of that page or to like that page, roughly 15% of them even have your updates show up in their news feed. Like Facebook actively calls out of your feed things they think you're not going to be interested in, or things by brands, or all this kind of stuff. So it's horrible because permission, you can reliably get people's attention and drive action. It doesn't do that. So let's not use it for permission. What is it good for? It's really great for groups, right? It's really great to connect with people one-on-one. Like people that won't return my emails, if I reach out to them on Facebook, a lot of times they'll reply to me. And so it is good for that. So let's use it for that. So I come back to the same thing with blogging. So 10 years ago, when I was first getting into online marketing and blogging was first hitting the scene, like to build a blog audience, all you had to do was have a blog. Like there were so few blogs out there that since you were putting out content on a regular basis, people found you and they subscribe. Well, now when I start a blog, I'm competing with like major news organizations and people that have had blogs for 10 years. So we need to just look at what they're good for and what they're not. So for instance, I blog sporadically. every couple of weeks. So I don't think anybody's going to come to my blog on a regular basis and say, does he come out with a new article today? But it's a really great place to put content that can be found for search engine optimization, and it can be shared. So what I do is I put a blog post up, and then I go to my email list, which is great at getting people's attention, and I email them and say, hey, go check out this blog post over here. So I'm using email for what it's good for, getting people's attention and driving action, and I'm sending them to a great place to store content, which is my blog post, that they can then share on social media, which brings people to my blog post, which gets them to subscribe to my email list, right? So each of these tools have strengths and weaknesses, right? Email's awesome because it shows up in a place where people are already living. Most people check, you know, 99% of their email that comes in. It's a great place to grab their attention. But it's not a great place to store long-form content because it gets dropped into their inbox and they never see it again, and they can't share it with their friends. They can't even send a link to a friend if they want to. So it's good for getting people's attention and driving action, bad for being shareable and storing long content. But blogs are great for being shareable and storing long content, but they're bad at getting people's attention and driving action, right? So we're going to look at what is it good for and what is it bad for, and use it only when it increases its strengths. Again, it's just like I'm not going to use a hammer to try to get a screw into a board. Like, I might get it started, but I'm mostly just going to be frustrated. So a lot of times people will do something like Facebook and they're like, oh, it doesn't work for me. Or they'll start a blog, and like the only thing they're doing is putting up new content every week, but they're not building an email list. They're not sending it out. And then they'll be like, well, blogging doesn't work. And I'm like, well, that'd be like saying hammers don't work. You know, it's like, well, they do work if you use them for what they're good for. They're really bad at other things, but really good at some things. So that's what I try to look at is I'm pretty agnostic when it comes to tools. And now, right now, the best thing for permission is still email. It trumps Twitter. It trumps Facebook. It trumps any other way to get people's attention and drive action. It comes along and starts outperforming email. Get rid of email. I don't care about email. I'm not like buying stock in email. What I'm doing is constantly testing new things, figuring out what it's good at, what it's not, use it for what it's good for, and don't use it for what it's not good for.
Great answer. I really like that. And I think people's personality has a lot to do with what tools they like to use as well. But anyway, I don't want to go off on a tangent because I want to ask you, you mentioned that you occasionally write these blog posts. And when you do, they tend to be quite mega blog posts about really interesting subjects. So you wrote this one about the truth behind the New York Times and the USA Today list, which went viral and you ended up on TV. And I certainly shared it. A whole load of people shared it. Now, amusing for the timing, yesterday I hit the USA Today list. Thank you. With my own box set. So it was a box set, a reduced price, and made it number 121 in the USA Today list. Now, you wrote on this post, you basically said, what is the truth behind the list? Are they all just a game? Is it all just pointless? What are your current thoughts on these lists?
Well, I want to be careful here because I don't think that they're pointless. In fact, I make a strong argument that being on a bestseller list is attached to money. And anytime something's attached to money, it's not pointless. So, the other thing is, I'm trying to figure out how to go into this conversation. Here's the thing that makes me actually the most angry. And, I forgot which author. Oh man, I forgot her name. Anyway, she sold enough copies to hit the New York Times list. She hit USA Today and they edited her off the New York Times list. And she wrote this long post about it. And here's what bothers me is that when you were 15 years old or 12 years old, or in my case, 34 years old, and decide you want to write fiction, it is set up for you to believe that a goal is to hit the New York Times bestseller list, and that that is something. It's like walking on the moon, right? It's like something that you dream about. And it's kind of set up of like, if you work hard enough, put the time in and become a writer that is popular enough that people buy a ton of copies of your book, you will one day be a New York Times bestseller. The unfortunate truth is that's complete is so the truth is that the New York Times bestseller list is more of an editorial list. It is not a bestseller list. A bestseller list, okay, let's define words here. Bestseller means it was the best selling. Okay, that's what I take it to mean. Like, that's, I think, what most people take it to mean is like a bestseller list are the books that sold the best. However, the New York Times is the books that sold the best that they also think are good enough to be on their list.
Okay? Good enough in an industry
like,
way.
Oh, yeah. In a way of like these people that are completely insulated inside their world think are good enough. So self-published books are not usually good enough. Man, when Howie came out with Dust, we sold tens of thousands of copies. I mean, made the number one New York Times bestselling book look like it didn't even sell that week. And he only hit number seven, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was seven. It was like not in the top five. And then Bill O'Reilly had me on his show, which like, I'm not a Bill O'Reilly. And this is what actually bothered me is like, I'm not a Bill O'Reilly fan. I don't believe half the stuff he says, but it's true. Like, because he's a conservative guy and he wrote a conservative book, somehow, even though he hit number one on every other bestseller list, he was like not in the top five again or like way down the list. And it's like, why? Like, that makes no sense. He was the best-selling title of the week, but yet he didn't hit number one on the New York Times list because – and they do all kinds of to kind of edit. They basically create a system where they get to pick what's up there. So the more true ones are the USA Today and Wall Street Journal list, which more accurately reflect actual sales.
Like the USA Today, the reason my box set was on there is because it's not just Amazon only. So the fact is, you know, if it was Amazon, if it was just on one store, people in Select might well be selling far more than me. The fact is you have to sell a certain minimum number on a second store.
Yeah.
There's no way it's the best selling. It's just you have to hit this arbitrary number.
Right. I do not understand how they can justify that a book sold on Amazon is somehow different than a book sold on Barnes & Noble or a copy sold at Powell's in Portland. Like, the fact that they weight those different, like, just like blows my mind. Like, what the f- do you mean that, like, if I'm a fan of somebody and I buy a book at Amazon, that my purchase doesn't count as if I had like gone down to my local book? Like, that makes no sense whatsoever. But yet that's how they weight them. Yeah, it's just like, it's just.
So I think we've gathered that it is gameable. And, you know, I went through, I guess, a process, and you're a process guy, right? You're a productivity guy. I went through a deliberate process in order to hit that list. And we're not going to go into it now. But, you know, in order, I think partly for me to prove, you know, because I talk about book marketing, it was kind of to prove to myself and my audience that I could do that as a single name author and not just as part of a multi-author box set. So it was kind of, it was a goal. So as a goal, right, it's still worthwhile. So that's, really interesting. So when you help authors launch and you teach authors how to book launch, is that still what's in your mind? You are still teaching them to try and hit those type of lists, or you're more focusing on the longer term aspects of building an author career?
I'm much more weighted. It depends on what role I'm playing. So just last week, an author hired me to help with their launch when a book comes out in March. And they specifically want to hit the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal list. So I am going to bend everything I do to hit those goals, which means I'm going to do things that will ultimately hurt their overall sales, but will give them a better chance of hitting those bestseller lists, because that's what I'm being hired to do. So again, I'm agnostic about this stuff. This isn't a moral thing. It's a know what you're getting into thing. Where for most authors, 99% of authors out there, authors like me who are not going to hit a major bestseller list no matter what they do, I say play the long game. Create a platform that can reliably sell books. Because if we try to tear away those kind of arbitrary goals of hitting a bestseller list, and we look at why we're doing this, we're writing, there's easier ways to make money. There's less excruciating things that we can learn how to do. Go learn computer programming. It's actually easier than writing fiction and will make you a whole lot more money, right? So we're doing this for bigger reasons. And I think most of us do it because we want to touch people's lives. We want to put our writing out to the world. We have things that we want to say. You know, I just read George Orwell's Why I Write, and he wrote because he was angry. Like, he would find an injustice in the world and he would write a book to fix it. And so, so that's why we're doing it. And so our real goal should be to connect with as many people as possible and get our writing in their hands. And I steadfastly believe that marketing a book and selling it is 100% moral, because if you at some point do not make money on this, you're going to stop doing it. You're not going to be able to do it. And so I think that it is a disservice to an author to give their book away when they should be selling it, to undercut the price of their book, or to not push really hard to sell their book. When I come out with a book, I believe that everybody should buy it. And so, so when I teach it, I do teach build a platform, and a platform is simply connecting with readers and being able to stay in contact with them long term. And everything you should do is to continue to add to their lives so that they'll be a part of your entire writing career. You know, I don't want to be a guy that wrote a book once. I want to be a writer, and I plan on doing this for a long time. And I want people that are on my email list now and buying my books now to be buying my books in 20 years and 40 years. And so I look at how can I build a platform so I'm connected to a large group of people. And then once I have that, how do I leverage that to actually launch and sell a lot of books?
Mm, fantastic. And because I've looked at what you teach, and I think it's awesome and it's really useful for people, we're going to do a webinar on book launches, which I'm excited about. So just tell people, I should say it's on Thursday, 15th of September, 2016, just in case people are listening later on. And I'll put all the details in the show notes. But what can people expect on that webinar, which will be a free webinar? They're going to learn some cool stuff.
Yeah, so I'm going to walk through my framework for how to launch a book. And so there's three things I look at whenever I launch a book. There's kind of three buckets that tend to get a lot of sales. And then I'm going to deep dive into like one of those things that any author can do with an audience of any size to actually launch and sell copies of their book. So again, these things scale. So if you only have, you know, 300 people you're connected to, you can launch and sell books to those 300 people. And what's great is by the end of your launch, those 300 people will be 400 people or 500 people. What I see if you do a launch the right way, and I'll talk about this, is that your audience will actually grow as you launch a book. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show the framework, because again, if you know the strategy, you can plug the right tools in. And so we're going to talk about the overarching strategy, and then I'm going to deep dive into one thing and just step by step show you how to do it. So it'll be a lot of fun. I love teaching this stuff. If you haven't noticed yet, I get a little passionate about it.
Yeah, no, I really like hearing you talk about it too. So people can find that at thecreativepen.com/Tim, T-I-M, and that will redirect to the sign up. So that is fantastic. It's been so good to talk to you. So where can people find your other stuff and your books and everything and the podcast online?
So the podcast is StoryGrid. So you can go to storygrid.com/podcast or just search StoryGrid on, I think we're on pretty much every podcast platform. If you want to find what I do, it's timgrahl.com, T-I-M-G-R-A-H-L.com, or just Google anything close to that and you'll find it. If you want to find, actually, after I was on Bill O'Reilly, if you just Googled New York Times bestseller list, I was like 12th in Google just for that. I was like, yes. But if you just Google like, you know, New York Times bestseller list scam, or like Tim Grawl, you'll find that article as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Tim. That was great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So thanks for listening today, and I hope you found this interview really interesting. And if you'd like to join Tim and I, we're doing a live webinar on Thursday, 15th of September at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. You can sign up to join us live or get the replay at thecreativepen.com/Tim, T-I-M. Tim will go through the three-part framework used to launch dozens of New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling books, plus how to launch your book with 25+ Amazon reviews. So it will be packed with useful information, and there's also going to be a live Q&A with me and Tim. So join us at thecreativepen.com/Tim. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.